have your attention, please. Please find a seat and we'll begin the meeting. And I welcome you to the Legislative Electric Energy Task Force meeting. This meeting will be primarily on greenhouse gas cap and trade information. But we do have one piece of information that we need to address before we get started. And that is that the CDED Task Force is scheduled to, the legislation enacting it, sunsets it tomorrow. And their report is due to the legislature today. They still have work that has to be done, and there is a copy of their interim report on your desk today, pointing out the background, the work that they have done, and their plan to complete their work. But we need to pass this resolution here today, titled the Legislative Electric Energy Task Force, that expands... that extends their existence so that they can complete this work. Has everybody found that?
I need a motion.
Senator Metzen? Okay, Senator Metzen moves that that we adopt the resolution. Any discussion about that? Then all in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Today, I thank you for that. Today we have three people who you will find are experts in the field who have come to speak to us about greenhouse gas cap and trade. And they have very extensive resumes and bios. And there is a copy of their bios in your packet today. I ask that you please review those to see just how impressive it is. But I am not going to go through all of them today in the interest of saving time. And what I would like to do is to take each of the three individuals one at a time. They will present. I would ask that you hold your questions for each of the individuals until they finish with their presentation. And then you may ask your questions. And then we'll move on to the second presentation and then the third presentation. So any questions or comments before we get started? Thank you. We will begin with Terry Tamminen. And I might mention that Mr. Tamminen is from the state of California, where he is in the cabinet of the governor.
Where it was 78 degrees when I left Santa Monica yesterday. But I'm glad to be back here in the Midwest. I'm from Wisconsin, so I can handle it.
Welcome, Mr. Tamminen.
Thank you, Senator, and thanks to all of you for allowing me to come and present today. I know that the bulk of today's time is, I believe, meant to be spent on talking about cap and trade, which is one strategy for dealing with greenhouse gases. I wanted to present first, though, on an overview of where states and regions and the world is going on greenhouse gas regulation and policy so that you might put the cap and trade component into perspective. And also because no matter how much you know about this, you may be surprised to learn that a lot of the landscape with respect to regulating greenhouse gases is changing literally by the week as more states take action in the absence of comprehensive federal policy. As the Senator mentioned, I am the former Secretary of California's EPA. I do continue to advise Governor Schwarzenegger and actually about half the governors in the country and numerous Canadian premiers and foreign leaders on climate change policy and energy policy. Currently, I do that from a nonprofit foundation, the New America Foundation, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization in Washington, D.C. I suspect all of you are familiar with this, just a real quick background setting. The red line indicates over the last several hundred thousand years the temperature changes, natural and otherwise, and then the green one, the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere up to the present day and then projected based on where we are likely to go through 2100. And this is the famous hockey stick graph, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, that really the debate is over about the state of the science about where our planet is heading in terms of greenhouse gas emissions and the changes to our climate. One other quick table-setting map that's useful to have is that, of course, the U.S. is home to 5% of the world's population, but 28% of the world's greenhouse gases. And when you factor in why China, for example, is building 1,000 megawatts a week of mostly coal-fired power plants, it's to power factories that are making plastic flamingos and Nike sneakers to sell to us. So we are directly or indirectly responsible for, I would argue, well over half of the world's greenhouse gases. Where do they come from? I think this chart would look roughly the same here in Minnesota as it does nationwide. About a third from electricity, a little less than a third from transportation, and about a quarter from industrial, which includes refineries. So if you take refineries and transportation together, that's actually about a third. And this is an important chart because when you talk about cap and trade, and our other presenters will get into the details of cap and trade, so I won't go into that now, but what you're doing is capping emissions from particular industries or emitters. And it's difficult to cap emissions from, say, a herd of dairy cattle or from individual drivers. So there are many sources of greenhouse gases, as you can see from this chart, that don't lend themselves to a cap and trade program. It's an extremely important tool, but it is not a silver bullet. And in fact, many people have said there are no silver bullets when it comes to solving the climate change challenge, only silver buckshot. And what are the reductions that are needed? Again, just to try to put this into some context, and most of the states that are taking action are looking at levels like this, reducing their greenhouse gas emissions roughly 30% by 2020, which is to get back to the 1990 levels, as much as 80% below 1990 by the year 2050. And scientists, there's some general agreement that if we are successful in doing that worldwide, that will stabilize our climate, meaning no more than 500 parts per million of CO2 or its equivalent greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, no more than a 2 degrees centigrade average temperature increase. Now, the latest reports from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, suggest we may be closer to the tipping point going over climate stabilization than previously thought, but that's a whole other area that we could talk about if you so choose. But in any event, I think most policymakers are aiming for reductions in this range in order not just to pick arbitrary numbers of reductions, but in order to do our part, whether it's as a state or a country, that assuming the rest of the world does their part, we will stabilize the world's climate. The benefits, I can speak to California. We did a lot of research into this. The lower end of our estimates from our 1,400-page climate report, which I'm happy to direct you to the link if you want to read 1,400 pages of one state's climate action plan and report. But there was a range that our economic modelers found, and by 2020, the lower end of that range is 83,000 new jobs and $4 billion a year of more income for the state, and a comparable investment nationwide leads to similar savings nationwide. And just to be clear, there's no question that there are costs in the early years, that there are also winners and losers. I'm sure our forefathers and foremothers 100 years ago sat in rooms like this and debated moving from horses and buggies and from ice boxes to refrigeration, and obviously there were winners and losers. There's no mistaking that, but ultimately this is a benefit to the economy. One other way of looking at this, and I focus among all the different fossil fuels on oil because I've done a lot of personal research on that. I wrote a book called Lives Per Gallon. And one of the reasons to do this quickly is about economic development and economic cost. It has less to do with the environment. That, for example, the fully laden cost of a gallon of gasoline in this country is somewhere around $10 when you factor in the subsidies to the petroleum industry, the cost of health care, asthma, and I'm not talking about lost productivity, which is another cost you could add in there, but when I did these calculations and presented them in my book, it was only things that are on somebody's balance sheet, actually costs to a taxpayer or someone, a business somewhere, and that's $10 a gallon. We just don't pay it at the pump. You'd find similar numbers with things like coal-fired power plants. Once again, we just don't pay it all on our electricity bill. The good news is that in the absence of federal policy on these issues, the states are on the move. And the states that you see here in green have begun to set targets for greenhouse gases. The ones in gold have set them, put them in law, and have comprehensive plans to achieve those targets. And as you can see, there's still a lot of white space on the map, but there's quite a few that have already begun with their targets. Even more have plans underway, which will ultimately include targets. As you can see, more than half of the states, actually 27 states, now have comprehensive greenhouse gas reduction plans that they've already developed or have in the development phase right now. Many have adopted as one of those plans California's emission standards in cars. You noted on that pie chart in the beginning that somewhere between a quarter and a third of our emissions come from the transportation sector. California, as you know, passed tailpipe standards for greenhouse gas emissions from cars. Many states have adopted that. We're, as you know, in a disagreement with the federal EPA about whether or not we can impose those standards, but the courts have ruled that we can. And as you can see, actually a majority of the U.S. car market now believes that we should. And many states also have renewable energy portfolio standards, which, as you know, means a percentage of the electricity generated by your utilities comes from renewables, and typically an increasing percentage over years. That's another very important strategy in terms of, again, think of that pie chart where a third of the emissions nominally come from the energy generating sector. So if we're converting much of that over to renewables, then we're, by definition, tackling that problem. And again, as you can see, more than half the states, even some of those that do not have comprehensive climate plans, do have renewable portfolio standards. So what does all this add up to? The upper line on this graph shows you the business-as-usual emissions of greenhouse gases in the United States going out to 2020. And if we want to get below 1990 levels, for the reasons I mentioned before, then the lower line takes you below the 1990 levels. The wedges in between are the different measures that most states are adopting. And again, no silver bullet, only silver buckshot. The top one in white, the large wedge on the top, is energy efficiency and conservation. And that, of course, is the measure that delivers the most immediate results. We could go through this room, for example, and replace these lights with more efficient compact fluorescents or LEDs, and literally in a matter of minutes save 10, 20, 30% of the electricity being used in this room. The same thing is true, obviously, with energy conservation measures, both as it relates to transportation and buildings throughout the country. Then clean and renewable energy is the next wedge, transportation and land use efficiency, and then the others, as you can see there. So, again, just extrapolating what the leadership states are doing to the national framework shows you that if all the states did what Minnesota is contemplating to do, that and has already begun, then we would actually do our part as a nation and get below 1990 levels by 2020. I believe, however, that there are three real keys to winning this, one of which is the topic of your discussion today, the cap and trade. I think that there are two others that go with that. As I mentioned before, energy efficiency and conservation, because you want to avoid this tipping point, getting to it before, while you're waiting for other solutions to come online, and it takes time. For example, if you have more fuel-efficient or alternative fuel cars, it takes quite a while for those to work themselves into the fleet, for people to buy them, and for us to see those results. If you start building more energy-efficient buildings, it takes a while for the inventory of buildings to turn over. So conservation, however, and efficiency are things we can do literally overnight. The second piece, of course, is clean and renewable fuels. We got into this problem mostly by burning greenhouse gas emitting fuels, carbon fuels, coal and oil. So moving to cleaner renewable fuels, studies show that it is possible to permanently and completely change over from fossil fuels over time, and obviously we'll have to. Those are finite resources. And then finally, a global carbon market, which will also give us a way to engage developing economies like China and India, which I'll talk about briefly in a moment, that using a cap and trade or other market mechanisms to harness the market to help us do this, to innovate and invest in these alternatives, is one of the quickest ways to get to these solutions. In the energy efficiency and conservation area, and again, we could spend much more time on this if the committee was interested. I know that's not the main topic, but these are some of the things that many states are doing to achieve that wedge that you saw in that graph to get the reductions from the energy efficiency and conservation sector. One of the ones that I think is often overlooked many policies is the decoupling of utilities' profits from how much they sell. I don't know if that's something that Minnesota is considering or has considered, but it's been very successful in California. For example, I know this is probably a little hard to see on the screen, but if you look at the chart on the left side, that's the use of electricity per capita by state. And the average American uses almost 12,000 kilowatt hours per person per year. You'll notice the red line at the bottom is California using under 7,000. So 40% less than on a per capita basis. And that's not because we don't have flat panel TVs and jacuzzis and air conditioners in the desert. It's because over the years we've imposed these building and appliance efficiency standards and used the public goods charge as a way of incentivizing the conservation measures, and because of decoupling that has led us to be the most energy efficient state in the nation. The blue arrow points to Minnesota, which is slightly average, and then on the right hand side is the gasoline use. Second of the three keys to winning, I believe, are the clean and renewable energies, and of course the renewable energy portfolio standard is a key to that. Extending renewables with things like hydrogen as a storage medium. For example, in California, if you build a wind farm, you will only get 19% of the rated capacity of that wind farm in renewable energy credits, because regulators don't trust that the wind will blow and generate electricity at the time of day when it's needed. So you'll only get 19%. I don't know what it is here in the Midwest. But obviously, if you use all of that electricity to do something like generate hydrogen, then run the hydrogen back through fuel cells to make electricity during a time of day when you need it, you could get that renewable up to 100%. And there are other storage mediums. I just used hydrogen as an example. Waste-to-energy capture and, of course, combined heat and power. These are things which I know you're doing here in Minnesota. There's a lot of potential in this particular sector, especially here in the Midwest. And then finally, the topic that you're looking to talk about today, I think, mostly, and that is the cap-and-trade mechanism. And you'll hear more about how cap-and-trade works in a moment, both from the theoretical perspective and from an actual application of it in the Northeast. But this is an interesting map because it shows that our western states in the dark green, your midwestern states in the blue, and the eastern, northeastern states in the green have already created regional cap-and-trade networks that are considering how to harness these market forces. The northeastern, the REGI as it's called, will be the first to come online, and you'll hear a presentation about that later. I suspect in the West will be second shortly after the REGI in 2009. And then your Midwestern one, of course, is still being discussed and debated. And these networks here in the United States also include some Canadian provinces and Mexican states as a way of already engaging our international partners. But the important thing about this is not only do these states realize that there's strength in numbers, because I don't believe any one state, even one as large as California, which by itself would be the seventh largest economy on the planet if it was a separate country, even California cannot go it alone. We could not create an effective cap-and-trade system by doing it one state at a time. These regional efforts recognize that there are regional differences in the economy and regional differences in the power grid and the way we generate power. Then collectively, just like think of different countries with different monetary currencies. As long as we all agree on a world scale what's behind those currencies, we can agree on an exchange rate and then come together to exchange, in this case, carbon credits from one system to the next. And all of these networks are working closely together as they're being developed so that that kind of an exchange will be possible. Similarly, in October of last year, we signed an agreement in Lisbon with the European Union. As you know, the European Union already has a carbon trading system up and running, and so we signed an agreement to synchronize these regional trading networks in the United States with the European system, because many of us believe that there's, again, strength in numbers, that the larger the market, the more competitive it will be, and the quicker it will bring down the cost of compliance, which is good for consumers and for businesses. You might ask, well, why isn't the federal government just doing this and doing it across the entire United States? It's politics, of course, and I don't think in this particular year that we're dealing with a presidential election and distractions in Iraq and other places that we're likely to take this issue seriously. This administration in Washington, President Bush has also made it very clear that he will not sign comprehensive climate legislation. So I think we are waiting for a new president and a new Congress. And I also don't believe that this is something that lends itself very well to a federal program first. Again, because you have very unique economic and power generation needs and interests in your region, in your part of the country, just as we do in the West. We generate electricity differently in California than you do here, and you do it differently than they do in Florida. And so I think it makes sense to start these regionally at scale and then bring them together. The other component of whether or not Congress will act, the blue line here represents business as usual. Again, greenhouse gas is continuing to go up over time. This is out to 2050. The various colored lines are various proposals in Congress to deal with climate change on a comprehensive basis. All of them include cap and trade. You'll notice only three of them, three which have no political support at the moment, actually reduce us to the levels necessary by 2050. The others level off our emissions, and many of them actually stop after 2025. Even the new Lieberman-Warner bill, which is not on this chart, which would look somewhere in between these, doesn't completely do the job, and I don't think we'll get past this year in any event. So we're not going to be relying on Congress. In fact, quite the opposite. I think next year Congress will be relying on you. We'll be looking to the states to see what we've done and building on that. So there are many opportunities, I think, for leadership in Minnesota. Obviously, the Midwestern states carbon market, getting that right, letting us learn from you and vice versa in the other markets, linking to the Western Climate Initiative and the regional greenhouse gas initiative and to the European trading scheme. And here, I think, better than anywhere, you can be demonstrating renewable energy projects, farm waste to energy, wind, and so forth. And certainly in a state where, what's the temperature today? You might want to focus on things like building heating efficiency, which if we go back to that pie chart, you'll see actually a lot of our greenhouse gases are generated from buildings. And you all have a copy of this PowerPoint with the links to my website and the website at New America. So if there's any way that I can be helpful in the future, or we can provide assistance to you as you go forward with your deliberations, please don't hesitate to ask. Also, one of the benefits of me working with many other governors and state legislators is that there are networks beginning to come together of these political leaders, so to the degree that we can help you connect you to people that have walked a mile in these shoes as they consider these policy implications and the economic implications and balancing the needs of your state. Again, we're very happy to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Kamenetz. Is there a complete inventory of all the strategies that California has used to reduce carbon emissions? And is that on the website, or is there some way that we could access that? Or
I'd be happy to email the link to you, but it's at the California EPA website, our climate change section. And the report, which is now about a year old, is, as I mentioned, 1,400 pages long, that lists all the different strategies, some of which are underway now, some of which are being designed. For example, it allocates a particular amount of reductions to come from our cap-and-trade system, but a year ago we hadn't designed it yet, so it simply says we're going to try to get this amount from cap-and-trade to be determined, and we're now in the design phase.
Okay. Are there questions among members of the committee? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wonder if you could comment on the question, and I know we'll hear more about this in the next from Steve Pulaski, but the question of how you're proposing to allocate the allowances for those who emit.
Mr. Kamenetz.
In California, as we look under our Assembly Bill 32, and then as we look regionally, I'd say most of the policymakers are looking at some kind of a combination of allowances and allocations. And again, since Steve and Rick will be going into that in more detail, I won't do that here. But I think there is some benefit to realizing that if you just auction 100% of the right to pollute or put some kind of a price on that from day one, it is kind of like dropping your economy into cold water. And those prices, or those costs, are going to be passed on to consumers and the businesses that may have adverse economic effects, depending on what those numbers are. If you allocate a certain percentage and then put a price on a certain percentage, maybe it's 50-50, 60-40, who knows, as you design that, you can kind of more slowly ramp up and give people time to adjust to that additional cost for something that up to now they've been getting for free. So I think that's something that reasonable policymakers are going to have to debate, and academics will have to advise you as to what would the impact be of a certain carbon price if you charged 100% or if you were to give allowances and charge for some smaller percent.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chairman, and thanks for your presentation. I was intrigued by your slide, the true cost of our oil addiction, and your statement that you know, a cap and trade wouldn't necessarily have that impact, of course, on the transportation-derived greenhouse gases. Do you have some thoughts based on your experience in California nationally about the best strategies to address greenhouse gases from the transportation sector?
Mr. Kamenin.
To be honest with you, I think as I look at all the different states and work in a number of different states and even in the European Union, that is the area that we have done the least quality work in terms of vehicle miles traveled, for example, and smart growth, trying to figure out, frankly, how to get people out of their cars and to drive less. That's the area where most policymakers have failed. In terms of pressing the technology, as you know, California has led the way in terms of trying to reduce greenhouse gases from cars and zero-emission vehicles, getting the vehicles to be more efficient, regardless of how many miles we travel. That's something we are fairly good at, finding ways to invest in mass transit as a way of helping people get out of their cars. That's you know, purely a fiscal matter. So the short answer is, we're fairly good on the technology side on improving the low carbon fuel standard in California, as an example, or alternative fuels, and the same thing with vehicles, but not so good in terms of changing the dynamics that lead to that source of emissions.
And Madam Chair, just a very quick follow-up then.
Representative Hornstein.
Also on that slide, you had a bullet point, fully laden cost of a gallon of gasoline, $10. Do you see, you know, given what we know about peak oil and, you know, the supply and demand curves on that, do you see just the trend line really steadily going up on the price, you know, the pump cost of fuel, and how rapidly do you see that curve going up?
I think we are years, if not months away from great price instability with respect to oil. $10 is the fully laden cost. Obviously, much of that is hidden, but the cost at the pump. I think you are in the next year to 2 years at most going to start to see shortages because of the worldwide shortage of refinery capacity, the competition from China and India and other emerging economies for refined fuels. Again, I go into more detail in my book. I'm happy to send you a copy.
I'd like a copy.
But I truly think that this is a very poorly understood area while we're talking about peak oil and then thinking that there's going to be kind of a downslope of discovery of oil and therefore time to ramp up. What we're ignoring at our peril is the lack of industrial capacity to turn oil into anything useful. And the fact that we're putting far more energy in for every unit of energy we get out over time. So, for example, we're focused a lot on the remaining oil in the Middle East, but the majority of oil on Earth that we know of is tied up in tar sands and tar shale in places like Canada, where it takes as much as 4 units of energy input to get 1 usable unit of energy out. That's going to consume a vast amount of our natural gas resources in North America, which will have a profound impact on energy prices and availability. But again, a lot of that simply isn't going to come to market fast enough, and so I truly believe you're going to see, even assuming that there are no geopolitical upsets or terrorism or other mechanical breakdowns like Hurricane Katrina impacted refineries in the Gulf Coast states, you're going to see severe disruptions and unpredictable price spikes starting as early as 12 months from now.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Canoe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I looking at the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative in the Northeast as well as the Western states, I mean, I think there's reasons to do this to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to set the stage for further work, but how do you think entering into a regional cap and trade impacts your region's ability to work within what we assume will be a national and international cap and trade system or greenhouse gas reduction system in the next few years?
I think it's essential to getting it right and making it effective, because if you look at our Supreme Court in the United States, it's ruled that greenhouse gases are pollutants as defined by the Clean Air Act, which means that Congress is more than likely, when they act, to look at the Clean Air Act as the model and essentially turn back to the states and say, here is the level of greenhouse gases your state may emit or that we as a nation will emit. Now it's up to you to come up with a state implementation plan to get below whatever your state cap is going to be. So it's ultimately going to devolve back to the states anyway. An individual state, I don't think, is large enough to enter into a cap-and-trade program on its own that would likely be effective and not lead to shortages of the supply of carbon credits and opportunities to reduce greenhouse gases, and therefore you're going to see price spikes that are unrealistic in the cost of carbon, and businesses, in fact, would probably move from one state to another in response to that. I think you avoid that by creating a market that is at least large enough in scale, but small enough to be regional and responsive to the needs of the regional economy. And so that's why I do strongly favor the way you've approached this in the Midwest and what we've done in the West and, of course, the REGI in the Northeast.
Thank you. Did you have a follow-up, Representative Smith?
Yeah, just a quick follow-up, Madam Chair. Do you think by having a regional greenhouse gas cap-and-trade, you are impacting the national, or what we assume would be a national system, in a way that benefits your region, or that makes sure that it takes, I mean, you've talked about regions having different needs and different energy economies, and by having different regions, do you think that helps your region influence what would be a national system positively?
Yes, I think it does, because I think now Congress, instead of acting in a vacuum and then, as I mentioned, just perhaps defaulting to the Clean Air Act, they'll look at what's been done regionally and say, fine, we will accept that as the functional equivalent you gave at the office, so to speak, for those of you that are part of those regional systems, and then set some minimum standard for those states that are not, perhaps even giving states that are not the opportunity to opt in to one of the regional programs at a certain level of effort, and then failing that, joining some kind of a minimal national effort. So I do think it will help us start at a higher bar, at a higher place, with much more respect paid to the individual needs of the regions and the individual states.
Any further questions? Senator Quigley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Tominen. Could you give us any information on how effective efforts at carbon sequestration have been in other states or in other parts of the world?
Senator, I'm not aware of any commercial scale successful sequestration projects anywhere in the world, to be honest. We have pumped CO2 from liquefied natural gas projects in Australia down into saline aquifers more than a mile below the floor of the ocean, but we don't know if the CO2 will stay there. We've used CO2 to recharge depleted oil fields in California as a way of sequestering the carbon, but then, frankly, as a way of bringing more oil to the surface that's domestic, which obviously has some benefit. But, again, we don't know if that CO2 will remain sequestered. There are laboratory projects, which are extremely exciting, that are turning emissions, CO2 emissions, into calcium carbonate or other substances which we can safely landfill or use for other industrial purposes, but they haven't been taken to commercial scale. Projects to grow trees, for example, to sequester carbon, have been rife with let's just say mismanagement, to be charitable, where a lot of claims made about how much carbon can be sequestered by a forest if you plant a bunch of trees, but somebody goes back 5 or 10 years later and finds half of them died or half of them didn't grow as fast as we thought and those types of things. So I think it holds tremendous promise, and especially given that we can't turn this battleship around as fast as we'd like to, and therefore sequestration of existing emissions and even absorbing existing carbon with things like growing, whether it's algae or trees or other types of projects, will be extremely important and even commercially important. But unless I'm just grossly misinformed, I have yet to see the commercial scale viable project that that any of us can rely on anytime soon. I hate to be that pessimistic about it, and they may be there, but I just have not seen it.
Well, just a follow up, Madam Chair.
Senator, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and again to the witness. You know, I guess, you know, kind of a related question to that, and I guess the reason I asked it is I've read some things that seem to be a bit off target too, as you mentioned, so you're confirming that piece. But I guess, how effective are the world's oceans as a carbon sink compared? I mean, you know, clearly they've got a higher level now than they have ever had, but you know, I guess I'm wondering, you know, is there a limit to what can be held there, or has any research been done on that?
Mr. Salmonen.
Senator, that is a very important question because, again, even as we're talking about sequestering carbon in various places, we not only don't know if it'll effectively stay sequestered, we don't know what side impacts it may have, as inherent in your question. The oceans, for example, intentionally or unintentionally, are the sink for about a third of our excess CO2 emissions today. And we are literally changing the pH of the ocean. We have literally altered the chemistry balance of the ocean such that kelp is dying off along our coastlines here in the United States. Coral reefs are being bleached out. And so it's having a very deleterious effect on the ocean. And we are an ocean planet. Two-thirds of this planet is covered by ocean. It's where most of our oxygen comes from. We are very dependent on the ocean. And yet we are slowly destroying it because of our excess greenhouse gas emissions. So to add to that by, for example, some have said, well, you might put iron oxides out in the ocean and stimulate the growth of algae as a way of taking up more CO2, but then that simply sequesters it in the ocean and may exacerbate the problem. So you're right, we don't have all the answers about those technologies.
Yeah. Well, just a comment, Madam Chair. Yeah, I guess, you know, I guess as I have accumulated a few grandchildren now, you know, I notice a little more that however the earth was put together, it was put together with two-thirds water, and I began to wonder if that doesn't tell me something about where we should spend more of our time.
Just an observation.
A retort, yeah. Any other questions or comments? Well, Mr. Tamanin, I appreciate your time. Certainly, the information is very helpful to us.
It's my pleasure, Madam Chair, and just two other quick points. I'll remain as long as I can if there are other follow-up questions later. And secondly, those maps that I showed you earlier are all available at the newamerica.net website that you see posted on the screen now. And when you hover your browser over any one of those maps, you can click on the state. So if you're interested in the RPS, if you're interested in executive orders signed by the governor, if you're interested in laws that were passed by the legislature on any one of those topics, it will take you directly to those websites of those states. So you might see this as a resource as you go forward, both for information and how those policies were put into law. Thanks to all of you for what you're doing.
Thank you. I'd like to now call on Dr. Steve Pulaski, who's a professor at the University of Minnesota in ecology, evolution, and economics. Is that correct?
Yep, it's two different departments, Department of Applied Economics and Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Behavior. But, yep, okay. Close enough.
Welcome, Dr. Pulaski. And please also, I direct you to his bio also. It is also quite extensive.
Thanks thanks very much for allowing me to presentation here, and I second kind of the enthusiasm and excitement. This really is sort of the climate is right for taking action and for thinking carefully about these issues. I'm going to get into kind of more of the nuts and bolts of how does cap and trade work? How can we think about that using cap and trade for greenhouse gas and climate change regulation? Before I launch into the PowerPoint, I want to say two things. One is that the basic idea of cap and trade is incredibly simple and incredibly powerful. So, you know, you don't need to be afraid of this. The very straightforward basic idea. Having said that, though, there are lots of implementation details that need to be paid careful attention to in order to get things right. And I'm very much looking forward to Rick's talk after mine for people who have tried to actually implement things and carry these out. And there's some very practical lessons that need to be learned in order for this to work as advertised. So, again, what I want to do is to provide a basic background on cap and trade, what is it, how does it work, and then get into some very specific implementation issues. We've already talked a little bit about allocation of allowances, monitoring enforcement, and so forth. So I'm going to go quickly over this. Terry set the stage very well. We're in an era where we are having environmental impacts, climate change being one, air and water pollution. Why cap and trade? I mean, why now? Well, we've had experience with environmental regulation, certainly in the 1970s at the federal level, thinking about the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act. Lots of cases sort of in the 1970s thinking much more about the direct regulation of technology, best available control technology, and so forth. If you read through Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, thinking about, you know, how can we specify technology so that the end of the pipe, the smokestack, or sewage outfall, that we limit the amount of damaging pollution that comes out. I'll claim that there's sort of a second wave of environmental issues that we're in now. These issues tend to be more global, certainly with climate change, and they also can be more diffuse. With climate change, we're really talking about energy. We're also talking about land use. This is widespread throughout the economy. It's not just one sector. It's not just a few point sources. You know, certainly there are large power plants which contribute, but as we've been talking about land use and buildings and driving to work, all of these contribute to climate change. So both because of the type of environmental issue that we're thinking about, as well as the experience that we've built up on regulatory approaches, there have been calls for more what I'll call flexible environmental regulation. So a real question to address with cap and trade or any of these sort of newer environmental regulatory approaches is, can we achieve the environmental goals with less acrimony, less red tape, and at lower cost? Okay, so that's one of the themes that I want to talk about in this push for market-based or incentive-based environmental regulation, of which cap and trade is one example. There are other examples. I'm not really going to be talking about them much, but you may have heard about carbon taxes. That would be another approach, sort of another kind of incentive-based approach towards trying to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Okay, so what might the advantages of these market or incentive-based regulation approaches be? It creates an economic incentive to meet an environmental goal. It allows flexibility for the regulated entities to figure out the best ways of meeting it. So we're not mandating how you meet it. We set out the goal, but say, you know, it's your industry, it's your practices, you figure out how best to achieve this. And by doing so, we think that we can attain the environmental objective at the lowest cost possible. The cap and trade idea has been around for quite some time. In economics, it can be traced back to an article published in 1968. The basic theory was worked out in the early 1970s. It didn't really get, as many things, the scribblings of academic economists, didn't really get a try in the real world for a number of years. But certainly, there were trials in the 80s, 70s and 80s. But the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments really put cap and trade front and center in environmental policy. There are a number of other examples of cap and trade besides thinking about the application in climate change. It also goes under different names in different areas, so emissions trading or marketable emissions permits. In the fishing industry, for example, people talk about individually transferable quotas. It's really the same thing. A quota is a cap. Transferable means that the fishers are allowed to trade. As I mentioned, the Clean Air Act, 1990, specifically the acid rain program and regulating sulfur dioxide emissions, was kind of the first really large-scale example of cap and trade. But there are other examples in air pollution and water pollution right here in Minnesota. There's been experimentation in the Minnesota River. The PCA has administered a point non-point source trading program. Examples from North Carolina, from Wisconsin, and other places. And obviously, talking here, the greatest interest is about thinking about climate change and greenhouse gas emissions. So you heard mention about the European trading system, the Chicago Climate Exchange, which is a voluntary organization. The University of Minnesota is part of that, by the way. But there are, and you'll hear more about the REGI, the East Coast system, regional greenhouse gas trading system. Just kind of some experience, or quickly, you know, what has been in our experience with cap and trade. The SO2 trading program that EPA administers has been widely viewed as being a great success. This chart shows what people thought might be the projected cost, the dotted black line for reaching the environmental standards. The blue line down below was the actual cost. This is the permit trading price for SO2 permits. And the red line is what's happened with actual SO2 emissions through time. Just very quickly, you all are more familiar with this, I'm sure, than I am. In 2007, last year, the greenhouse gas emissions regulation, really setting the stage for thinking about both what's the scale of emissions reductions that we're trying to aim for, and you know, the last line on here, 80% below 2005 levels by 2050. That's a major shift, and so we're going to have to start thinking very seriously about how are we going to implement that, how are we going to get to that level of greenhouse gas reductions. The plan is to, you know, there's a charge out here to look at the costs and the benefits of a regulatory system, and looking at, in particular, cap and trade system. So what I want to do now for the next few minutes is go through some of the basics of cap and trade, and then, as I said, some of the particular implementation issues that one needs to think about to have a successful cap and trade system. Okay, so what is cap and trade? As I said, the basic definition of cap and trade is very simple and straightforward. There's really two parts, not surprisingly, the cap part and the trade part. Right, so the cap is the limit on the total amount of emissions, oftentimes called, or you've already heard me talk about allowances or permits. So there are the equal number of allowances or permits to the total amount of emissions that are going to be allowed. Okay, so, you know, by setting the cap, you're basically saying this is the limit on the amount of emissions that we're going to allow for greenhouse gases or for air pollution or whatever it might be. Okay, so once those allowances are allocated, then comes the trade part. So emission sources may trade allowances with other emission sources. At the end of a commitment period, or at the end of a time, those sources have to hold allowances, which they either were initially allocated or they purchased, equal to or greater than their emissions, or be subject to penalty. So again, the idea is very simple. We have a total cap. We hand out or sell in some fashion the allowances to the permits. They can trade amongst themselves. At the end of the day, they have to hold permits equal to or more than their actual emissions. Okay, so that's the basis of cap and trade. Okay, so just to give an example, a really simple kind of toy example. Suppose we were trying to reduce emissions by 50% via cap and trade, and I just have a really simple idea here, firm A and firm B, two sources of emissions. Okay, and they each emit 4 units under, quote, business as usual. So before regulation, before they change anything in their business, 4 units of emissions. So we have a total of 8. We're going to have to reduce back down to 4 if we're going to reduce by 50%. Let's hand out 2 allowances to each firm. That's a grand total of 4. And suppose that it's much more costly for firm B to reduce emissions than it is for firm A. Okay, so here's just a simple made-up chart. Firm A and firm B, if you look down, so BAU emissions of 4, so if they don't do anything, they don't cut, they don't have any cost of reducing, the more they cut, the lower the emissions, the more the cost is. So total cost would be, if I wanted to reduce, for example, in firm A, down to 1 unit, the total cost of getting there would be $6. Okay, it's 3 times as costly for firm B, so you'll look and you'll see that the numbers there are at least 3 times as high as for firm A, getting to any given level of reduction. Okay, so if there were no trades allowed, each firm would have to reduce 2 units. If we go back onto that chart, you can see it, I can't. The total cost of each firm reducing by 2 units, 3 for firm A, 9 for firm B, or a total of 12. Okay? So that would be a baseline. We get to our 50% reduction, we don't allow trade. Okay, if we allow trade, what would happen? Well, firm A can clean up more cheaply than firm B. Firm A will sell 1 allowance to firm B. That will actually equalize the price of the permit at $3 per unit, $3 per permit. If you then go back to the chart and look at what the total cost is here, it's going to be reduced from what it was before. Okay, so the cost savings here will be $3, $12 without trade, $9 with trade. It's there are literally gains from trade here, which is one of the economic advantages of a cap and trade system. We allow sources where it's cheapest to clean up, sources where it's more expensive to reduce emissions can buy the permits from others. Okay, so this will lead in the end to the lowest cost means of attaining the cap. That's the theory. Okay, here's just a picture. Sorry, I am an economist. You have to be an economist, you have to show one of these kinds of graphs. But basically, what's going on here is the higher marginal cost from firm B, they will end up buying a permit, reduce emissions less. They'll be moving to the right from the midpoint allocation. Firm A will have to clean up further, but since they have lower costs, the blue triangle shows the gains from trade or reduction in emissions costs from trade. Okay. So to reiterate or summarize here, there are 2 parts, and one can really separate these into easily into, in a sense, the environmental part and the economic efficiency part. So the cap part is about the environmental goal. It limits the amount of emissions. If you want stricter environmental standards, that means you should lower the cap, right? Have fewer allowances. If you're worried about the cost of meeting the goal, you would tend to have a looser cap, more allowances. Okay, but the environmental side is really about the cap. Where do you set the cap? What level should you set the cap? Well, an economist's answer is not that anybody ever listens on this, but the economist's cap would be to say, well, think about what are the benefits of emissions reductions, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, for example, and how would that compare to the cost of getting that. Finding out the marginal benefits is quite a difficult task in most cases, and so really what's done, as I said, I've never actually seen that approach taken in practice. The cap is usually set using rules of thumb. So, for example, in the Minnesota statute, we're trying to aim for an 80% reduction by 2050. Okay, so that's where the cap will be. Okay, the second part, the trade part, is about economic efficiency. It reduces the cost of meeting the environmental objective. That's the reason why economists like this approach, why it's a more flexible mechanism, or why it attains environmental objectives at lower cost. It will give different distribution across sources. That may be important in some cases. Not so much for greenhouse gases, but you can imagine for water pollution or other cases where the where or the location matters a great deal. It may not be a good thing environmentally to have sources trading across different locations. But as long as the unit of emissions is really the same no matter where or when it's emitted, then trade does not affect the environmental objective. So we get an economic gain and no change on the environmental side. Okay, why is efficiency important? For economists, this is we obtain the environmental objective using the fewest resources, or we can get more of the environmental objective for the same amount of cost. Okay, politically, this reduces the opposition to achieving environmental goals. Okay, so now let me get to some of the specific issues of cap and trade. And I want to talk about, briefly, eight issues, the first two being the ones that I'll talk most about, and then more quickly on the latter set of six issues. Probably the most contentious and one of the most important ones is the allocation of allowances. And in fact, it's already come up as a question. So what method should be used to allocate allowances across emission sources? There's two main ones. One is auctioning, and the other is to hand out allowances to sources, or called free distribution. As Terry already indicated, we can mix and match across, hand out some, auction some of them. In fact, the EPA and the Clean Air Act does that. They hand out most of them, but they reserve a certain percentage of them to auction off. Auctions sold to the highest bidder. Free distribution, well, you can hand things out in a number of different ways. Oftentimes you'll hear people talk about grandfathering emissions, hand them out based on historical emissions from some baseline period. You want to make sure that the baseline period is enough in the past so that you avoid trying to game the system by manipulating the baseline in order to get allowances. This is probably the most common method of allocation of allowances, this is grandfathering method. So back to our simple example with firm A's and firm B's. If they both had the total of four allowances, then they had the sort of equal allocation, they would each get two permits, and we can run through the math and see, you know, what would happen. They would trade, and the total cost to the firms would be 9 and 12, but 12 of that dollars would be revenue actually to the government. They'd have to be, I'm actually in the auction. So if I was in the auction and they had to buy these permits, the cost of the permits would be 3. You see the two lines here, the cost of purchasing the allowance and then the cost of emission reductions. So the total cost for each firm. The total cost here would be 21, but 12 of that is revenue to the government. The total cost of actually reducing emissions is 9. Sorry for the I switched the order of these slides. If, on the other hand, we handed these out free to the firms, the total cost of reducing emissions is still $9. You get to the same point. The only difference between the allocation of allowances, handing them out by grandfathering, or auctioning them off is the distribution. In one case, firms will be paying for those permits, so there'll be revenue going to the regulatory authority, be it the government or whoever. In the other case, you're handing these out for free, so you don't have that transfer of revenue. Okay, both end up at the same point. You end up at this efficient means of emissions reduction costing. The difference is, as I said, the allocation of the distribution of money between, in this case, firms and the regulatory authority, being the government. Okay, what are the advantages and disadvantages of each of those means of allocating the allowances? Economists generally favor auctioning the allowances. This is sort of a simple common sense a point here. These are valuable assets. Once you put on a cap, you've now created scarcity, and these are valuable assets. So why should they just be handed away for free? There's also this notion that if you are doing something which is harmful, pollution, the polluter pays principle says you should put the cost on the source that's causing the harm. The revenue can be used in a number of different ways. It can be either put back in environmental programs, or more generally, or reduce taxes. And the last advantage is it treats all entities fairly. So there's no penalty for new entrants into an industry that don't have a historical level of emissions. On the other hand, the advantage is people who favor the free distribution. It imposes lower costs initially on emission sources. It also makes this more politically viable. You don't have the kind of upfront or economic cold bath that Terry mentioned. And this is the way basically most systems have started. But I do want to emphasize, most economists favor the auctioning method. There is a question about, if you can them out, sort of who ends up with the benefits. Is the benefit passed on to consumers, or is it held by the firm? And there are, it depends basically on the circumstances. One can come up with examples where who ends up with this valuable asset, who benefits from that. It can go either way depending on circumstances. Okay, so next I want to talk about monitoring and enforcement issues. For cap and trade systems to work, you have to have an accurate and verifiable method of monitoring emissions. For the SO2 program from EPA, on every regulated source, there's a continuous emissions monitoring system. It takes about 7% of the total cost is for compliance on this system, so it's not insignificant. But there must be some means of knowing what regulated sources, what they're emitting. Typically for greenhouse gases, this will be based on the amount of fuel used times the carbon content of the fuel. Again, at the end of the specified commitment period, you have to have the amount of, the number of allowances has to be greater than or equal to the amount of emissions that you've been verified to have had. What if you're short? Then what? You need to think about some type of enforcement strategy. So what happens if somebody does not have a number of permits? For the acid rating program, US EPA, what they did was establish a very high penalty price, so $2,000 per ton of SO2 and rising with inflation. And that's about 10 times the price or more than what a permit has. So there's a fairly high penalty for not having enough permits to cover your emissions. The other thing that, just practically speaking, needs to be done is to have what's called a true-up period. So it takes time to get all the records to figure out what the level of emissions actually has been within a time period. So usually there's a period of months after it that you allow people to figure out exactly how much they emitted and to buy the number of permits necessary to cover their emissions. 2 months in the case of the SO2 program. Okay, those were the two biggies. The next ones are fairly quick, but they're also very important. The point of regulation. Who should be responsible for having allowances to cover emissions? So from the electricity sector, for example, should it be the generator of the electricity? Should we have what's called a load-based system, so those who are responsible for supplying end users? Should it be end users? There are two considerations here I think that are important, especially for the context in Minnesota. First, we want to minimize the cost of compliance. You certainly don't want to go to every residential user of electricity and have them responsible for covering their emissions. In general, people suggest going, quote, upstream, where there are fewer entities and where they're more able to bear the regulatory burden. The second issue is the scope of regulatory coverage. So if this was a Minnesota program, and in the Minnesota program, people have talked about, well, what about imports of electricity from other states? Minnesota regulations cannot cover generators in other states, but we certainly can cover the load bearing within the state. And so generally the preferred option here would probably be the middle, of course, the load-based system. Okay, in terms of sector coverage, and Terry actually talked about this quickly, so what sectors should be covered? In principle, I would argue there's an advantage to having a wide coverage. So as many sectors as could conceivably put in, that gives you coverage of the total amount of emissions. In practice, there are, in fact, difficulties in monitoring and enforcement and in regulation that will preclude some sectors from inclusion. And so that's the type of thing that you might want to think about, other forms of regulation. So, for example, terrestrial carbon came up. Certainly forests sequester carbon, agricultural soils sequester carbon. Could they be included? In principle, yes. There is a difficulty in getting accurate measures. There's also a difficulty in the number of landowners. So typically, these sectors have not been included in cap and trade. They can be included in other programs, fuel efficiency standards, low carbon standards on transportation fuels, and so forth. There is a general issue that one needs to think about in how cap and trade fits with other regulatory programs then. Okay, if there are sectors which are outside, that raises the question of offsets. What offsets are is that if you can demonstrate that you have emissions reductions, you've sequestered carbon, for example, could you then sell that emissions reduction into a sector which is regulated by cap and trade and count that as an allowance? Advantage is that offsets extends incentives to cut emissions to additional sectors, and there is in fact a booming market in offsets right now. The disadvantage is that in a sense it weakens the cap. So there's these sectors outside that can create allowances. That means that you have more allowances floating around in your system. And it also, there's a potential for abuse. If you can really regulate, accurately and verifiably monitor the system, my argument would be they should be in the cap in the first place. And if they can't, then they shouldn't be allowed to create allowances. With offsets, you may have heard about the term additionality. So would the source have done the action to reduce emissions anyway? If so, you may not wish to give credit for that. But that raises the difficult question of, can you determine sort of what additional would have been done anyway, or what the new emissions reduction? Okay. The last three issues I'm going to cover very quickly. One is called banking. If you save up allowances from one commitment period, so you didn't have enough, you have lower emissions than the number of permits or allowances that you had, can you save them and use them for later? It's called banking. The SO2 program, for example, allows banking for things like climate change, which have a long residence time, so the when you emit doesn't matter so much. Banking is a reasonable option so that you kind of smooth out when emissions reductions occur. If somebody can do it early and they want to save it, it's a reasonable option. My only caveat on this is if when matters, then banking may not be desirable. And I don't think this is an issue with greenhouse gases, but it is an issue for some air pollution. So air pollution differs between winter and summer. We get inversions at different times. You wouldn't want to treat emissions of criteria air pollutants the same necessarily in winter and summer. You wouldn't necessarily want to allow trades across those time periods because they would have different environmental impacts. A related issue here is early action credit. So what if somebody does something now before the program, before a cap is actually in place? Would you want to give a reward for this early action? In a sense, this is a form of banking. You allow them to give a credit that they could then redeem later on and use, kind of repay that allowance later at a later date. You get to the same kinds of questions that face those offset issues, namely, is this an additional ton? Should you actually give credit for it? And so on. Okay. One of the last issues I want to talk about is called the safety valve. We're in uncharted territory here with climate change, and especially with the level of emissions reductions that we're likely to be calling for. Caps are often said to be technology forcing. In other words, we're going to have to come up with new ways in order to meet the caps and do so in an affordable standard. What a safety valve does is it basically establishes a price and allows entities to buy allowances at that price. So instead of meeting the standard, trying to reduce their emissions, they can buy additional allowances. And they'll do so if it turns out to be very costly to meet the standard. Okay, what a safety valve does is basically make cap and trade more similar to emissions taxes. So without the safety valve, what happens is the cost may vary a lot. So in a sense, the uncertainty plays out on the economic side. With the safety valve, firms have a set price that they can always utilize. And so the uncertainty, in a sense, plays out on the environment side. So firms will buy more permits in some circumstances if it turns out to be expensive. Okay, the last issue is called hotspots. And very briefly, the idea of hotspots is that if the location or the timing of emissions matters, and this is more important for things like water pollution or for mercury emissions, and some air pollution, you don't want to necessarily allow trading across locations or across time because it can give rise to localized pollution problems or hotspots, in which case you might want to limit trading across geographic scope or temporal scope I talked about before. For greenhouse gases that uniformly mix in the atmosphere and last a long time, hotspots is really not an issue. So I would say, things like banking, allowing trades across geographic zones. In some sense, climate change is the perfect, greenhouse gases are the perfect thing for cap and trade because you don't have this hotspot issue. So just to wrap up, there are really good environmental and efficiency arguments for using market-based mechanisms such as cap and trade. But as I've gone through, there's a lot of institutional details. There's a lot of learning by doing that has to occur in order for us to realize these environmental goals in a cost-effective manner. So with that, I'll stop.
Seems very, very complex.
Okay. Well, let me pose. I don't want to overwhelm you with a second message because I really do think that one of the basic messages here is that the essential element of this is really simple. The cap and trade part is a very straightforward and powerful idea. So.
Well, can you tell me this? And it's a very, very simple question, but I really don't know how you measure CO2 emissions. Is it something that you can take, like a temperature, or do you measure it by the effect on the environment, or the change in temperatures, or is there a measure that can tell you how much the CO2 has been emitted and how much you're trading and things like that?
Yeah. So there is typically what's done it is not the same thing as like measuring the smokestack. On like SO2, you put a monitor on the smokestack and you register the sulfur dioxide that's coming out. For CO2, basically what you do is you look at the fuel that's used, and there is a known carbon content per fuel. You take the carbon content per fuel times the amount of fuel that you've used, and that gives you your carbon emissions.
Okay.
So for fuel use, it's pretty straightforward. Where it gets a little more dicey are the land use side, and that's why most of the cap and trade programs, are typically focused on energy use and not having the land use changes involved.
Okay. Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, on that, you talked about the allocation of allowances and the free distribution, and said something about not knowing who would actually benefit, whether it be the firms or whether it would be the end user. Shouldn't we know that before we go into something like this? I mean, shouldn't we know whether or not the consumer is going to be paying way more or whether the firm is going to be? I mean, how do we determine that beforehand?
Yeah, it's a very good question. The reason why I said, in a sense, it depends. It depends upon the way that this is structured. But I completely agree with you. You want to have a very good guess about where, who's going to benefit from the allocation. So if this is a regulated industry versus not, so if this is an electric utility sector versus not, that can influence who actually ends up with benefiting. You know, is the cost going to be passed on to consumers, or is it going to, in some sense, the industry itself is going to bear it? Part of that depends upon sort of how competitive this industry is. So the reason why I said it depends is there are a number of specific circumstances which you have to figure out. I'm gonna ask, I think Rick actually is with Reggie. I mean, this is an issue that in the Northeast states that they have actually wrestled with, and so they've learned some lessons on sort of who is it that benefits. So I'll pass to him on kind of more details on it.
And then, Madam Chair, on the
Senator Thomas
in the auction form of doing this, isn't it conceivable that one company could bid the price way up on the auction and suddenly we got a commodity that we're selling and we've got a commodity business going on here? Is that what the idea is? Maybe that's what the idea is. I'm not sure.
So,
but
back to Platt.
Yeah. So on the auction, you want to have a competitive auction. So you have to have enough suppliers. You don't want to have one source, which is a large fraction of this industry. If you have a large fraction of the buyers of the permit. So I would argue, you know, you want to go beyond, for example, a one-state program where you only have, like, if you had a very narrow sector coverage, like only electric utilities, and you only did this in Minnesota, you have a small number of fairly large players, and you'd have to worry about their ability to manipulate the auction price through their actions. So, yeah.
So,
Senator Tomasoni.
So does this need to be then a national program that is initiated by the federal government, or is this a national program that's initiated by industry? How do you foresee what how this works?
Dr. Pulaski.
I think once you get up to the regional scale, you've got enough different entities across different states that you would. My sense is that you would get out of the kind of market power manipulation for permits fairly easily once you get beyond a very, you know, like a state-only program. It's something, though, that I would certainly look into even at a regional level. The broader the program, certainly at a national level, there's a large number of entities. The more that the program is covering multiple sectors, not just the electric utility sector, that's also going to get in sort of more players into this market and make it more competitive.
Senator Cooper.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess following up on Senator Tomasoni's thoughts a little bit, I guess, and to go back to your example, I mean, what advantage would Company A has if they can meet the per unit reduction at $3 to bid more than that at the auction? I mean, you know, where Company B could easily go, twice the amount that Company A could and still have a net gain for their shareholders or for their annual meeting or whatever you want to call it. I mean, you know, it seems to me that those that have a per unit reduction that has a higher cost assessed would have a much greater ability to pay a higher price, and why would anybody else want to pay something for it when they could do it voluntarily without, you know, the possession of one of these units, whatever you call them.
Dr. Pulaski.
In fact, that's exactly the point. You want the sources that it's a bit, you know, the sources that it's very expensive for them to reduce their emissions are the ones who have the greatest incentive to bid high in the auction. Mm-hmm. So in my example, Firm B would actually buy three permits and Firm A would buy just one permit, and the permit price would be at $3, which would be the marginal cost for each of them to reduce further their emissions. So, in fact, Firm B would be spending much more at the auction than Firm A because they want to have more permits at the end of the day.
Right.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've heard people say that the European experience didn't work very well because they gave allowances away rather than auctioning them. Do you know anything about that? I'm not really sure what the reasoning is, and I guess maybe to follow up on that, you said that economists prefer auctioning, but I'm not quite clear why.
Okay. So let me answer the second, and I'll probably look to my compatriots here to answer the first. So why do economists tend to favor the auctioning? If you really pressed economists, what they would really like to do, especially for along with pollutants like carbon, is to go with what economists call a price mechanism. So if you really could do a carbon tax, which I know is politically not a very popular option, there are kind of economic reasons for thinking about regulating via price mechanism versus a quantity mechanism. So what I mean by a price mechanism is you can emit as much as you desire, but you have to pay a price for that. Okay? A quantity mechanism is like the cap and trade. We're going to set a limit on how much quantity can be emitted. So that's what the cap is. If there is uncertainty in the system, and the system is long-lived, or the pollutant is long-lived, there are advantages to actually having kind of the uncertainty play out on the price side, rather, you know, to have the price mechanism rather than the quantity mechanism. So that's one reason. The other reason economists tend to favor this is that if you, in a sense, what you get to do with the auction is you're raising revenue, and you're raising revenue on a bad. So it's, you know, you're basically saying we're taxing something we don't want people to do. We now have this revenue, which we can then turn around and either reduce taxes on good things like labor. We don't really want to be taxing labor, but that's the way we raise revenue. So we can either reduce taxes on other things which are beneficial, like labor or property, or we can use that money to directly funnel back into good programs like environmental or energy, energy efficiency programs. So those are the reasons. But again, I think there are some practical things here in terms of what both politically and then as Terry brought up, kind of the timing of things and how this issue actually plays out. But the economists, like, you know, as I said, the economists tend to favor the auctioning mechanism for the reasons I suggested. Now, in terms of the European approach, I don't know, Rich, if you want to answer that when you get up there? Okay.
Dr. Pulaski, maybe you answered this when you were explaining to Senator Anderson, but you've commented a few times on carbon taxes and seeing that as, I get the impression you see that as something that would be more manageable than the cap and trade. I'm wondering if you could address perhaps some of the differences between carbon taxes and cap and trade, or is that a whole new lecture and the benefits of one over the other?
I'll say a few words on it. In some ways, a carbon tax is simpler. We don't need to worry about setting up the trading regime. We don't need to set up the, how are you going to hand out allowances and how many. You basically start the system by saying there's a price, say $10 per ton of carbon, and everybody who emits pays that price. So we already have, we do things like this similarly already. Many states have sales taxes and so forth. So the mechanism for doing such things are not different than what we have done before. Cap and trade is pretty much, it is more novel. There are examples, as I've indicated, but there are issues here that come up with cap and trade that don't come up with other types of regulatory mechanisms.
Why would you choose one over the other? Does one provide better efficiencies or reach our goal faster than the other?
The differences between them, I think the essential differences are twofold. So the first difference is basically who pays. So if you do a tax, it's clearly the emitter that's going to have to pay into, you know, it's going to have to pay for this. If you auction the permits, you auction the allowances, then again, it's the emitters that are paying. So that way, the cap and trade system is very similar to a tax system. If you hand them out freely, then it's very different. Basically, it's not the, you know, you're giving away this asset. So there's a different distribution under that sort of grandfathering scheme or handing them out than there is for the for auctioning them or for the tax. So that's one difference. The second difference comes back to my answer to Senator Anderson's question, which is where does the uncertainty play out? If you do a price system, basically you're telling firms this is what you're going to have to pay, but you don't necessarily know how much they're going to reduce their emissions by, because it depends upon their cost. So you kind of have certainty on the economic side. You tell firms you're not going to have to pay more than this, but we don't know exactly how much we're getting on the environment side. If you do the cap, you know what you're getting on the environment side, because it's the cap, but the uncertainty plays out in terms of the cost. We don't know how low or high that will turn out to be. So those are the main differences between the price mechanism of carbon tax and the quantity mechanism, the cap and trade.
So conceptually, people could pay and pay and pay, and we'd never get any reduction in emissions.
That is correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's especially true if you think that people are not very flexible. In other words, we've seen gasoline prices go from $1.50 to $2 to $3 per gallon and not see much change in behavior. So people are fairly insensitive to the prices, and you establish a fairly low price, and you would not expect much change actually in the actual number, an actual amount of emissions.
Okay. Further questions or comments? Thank you very much, Dr. Pulaski. And we have another speaker, and that is Frederick Weston. And he is the director of the Regulatory Assistance Project. And again, I direct you to the bios in front of you. Mr. Weston.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Madam Chair and others. It's great to be here. This is very honored. My two predecessors on this panel, well, we had a debate when we first met this morning about who would go first, and I thought having them go first would be great because they would do as, in fact, they did do, and that is say virtually everything I was going to say. But when Professor Pulaski now has punted on two questions, I feel a little bit like Stephen Stills right now. I just want to make sure that we're here all talking about the same thing. We're talking about capping and trading the electric industry. We're not talking about capping and trading professional athletes. I'm from New England, and you folks have given us a whole bunch of professional athletes in the last couple of years that have made us very happy. Had to think about that, didn't you? Okay, I have far too many slides for the time I've got, and I'm going to be skipping a bunch. We can come back to them if there's something in here. Most of them, the ones I skipped, have already been touched on by my colleagues. So I'm just going to bounce right through these. First, by starting with an explanation of who I am and what my firm is. I'm a former utility regulator from the state of Vermont. I was for 11 years an economist and hearing officer with the Public Service Board. I've, for the last 8 years, been one of five partners in a very small nonprofit called the Regulatory Assistance Project, which was originally founded in 1992 by two former regulators from Maine. We are funded by grants from philanthropic organizations and the Department of Energy and EPA to provide technical assistance to state policymakers, state and federal, and in some cases foreign governments as well, on the very issues that we're here talking about today. So we're here to be taken advantage of, and I appreciate that. Okay. We saw this before. I'm just going to pass over, why we must act now.
The bottom number is the 450 parts per million number, around 500 that Terry was talking about earlier. Why we must act, in keeping with the Elizabethan poetic theme that was struck earlier, we must act for present comfort and future good. But as you can see here, the United States is still responsible for by far the most anthropogenic carbon dioxide emissions in the world. Electricity is 41% of it, not including agriculture and forestry. It's important to understand that we've done a great job in reducing emissions from fossil fuels, from burning fossil fuels, particularly in the coal sector. Usage has gone up, emissions have gone down. But on this list, on this graph, you can see the problem. Carbon's not there. You can deal with particulates, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, because they are all amenable to, in one way or another, smokestack amelioration. Carbon dioxide is not, and that's why we're here talking about this today. Where are reductions going to come from in the power sector? I'm going to talk mostly about the REGI experience, but I want to sort of get there by asking a couple of the key questions, and then when we get through that, talk about some of the alternatives that you all might want to be thinking about. REGI is the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, is a power sector cap and trade program, just the power sector. It is built with the expectation and the hope that it will become multi-sectoral in the economies of the states that are part of it. But just in the power sector, what are we talking about? Where are we going to get emissions reductions from? Obviously by reducing demand, the environmental dispatch of existing generators. This goes to how much each generator operates according to its marginal costs. And if we include the environmental costs of their emissions, does that change the dispatch of generation? Shutting down the most polluting units, perhaps, adding clean generation. And for each opportunity, I would counsel all of us to ask, how many tons will it avoid? How much will it cost consumers per ton? Because in the end, it's consumers who are going to pay. And what tools get the best results, in particular on numbers 1 and 2, because numbers 3 and 4 are fairly directive and easily enough done. This is a far too busy slide, but I put it in to point out some interesting numbers. This is done by the McKinsey folks. On the far left, you see what's circled there is residential buildings and lighting efficiency. These are the costs per ton of CO2 reduced. And what you see here is for all those bars that go below the line, it means there's a negative cost associated with achieving the reduction in carbon dioxide. And on the right, there's a positive cost. There's a negative cost for efficiency and other such activities because efficiency pays for itself on economic grounds. Okay, so it's free. Anything you're getting is free in the way of emissions reduction. On the far side, I've circled what would effectively be what we think might be carbon capture and sequestration. And the costs there, as you can see, are positive. But that's just to give you an idea of the range of measures that are out there. And things, I think, we're going to have to do all of these to meet the targets that we're all talking about, but I wanted to give you an idea of where some really low-cost savings are and why they ought to be captured first. And even saving a small amount in electricity usage per year, 1% per year, can make a huge difference in your usage and then, therefore, in emissions output. This question came up in Professor Pulaski's talk. I just want to reiterate it. This is something that we've been giving a lot of thought to, and it has affected. It's been critical to the REGI design. But what's the best point of regulation? The question I would ask you is the principle of polluter pays is an important principle. I fully agree with it. And I'm going to ask you who the polluter really is. Terry talked about China producing much of our consumer goods. And in effect, then, it's our demand for those goods that's creating pollution elsewhere and carbon the carbon dioxide that is in the atmosphere as a whole. So it's an important question to ask, you know, who is the polluter? And by asking that question, it then may invite us to consider alternative points of regulation. And by alternative, I mean alternative to the generators themselves. But let's talk about that. And what works for one sector may not be appropriate for others. So in a multi-sectoral approach, you can decide that you want load-serving entities in the power sector to be the point of regulation, but yet you want manufacturers of concrete to be the point of regulation in another sector. And there's no incompatibility in that sort of design because the allowances are tradable and it's just an open it's just a market. All you've done is just determine who has the obligation. Okay, Terry had a slide like this. State and regional power sector carbon regimes, I wanted to point out the West, obviously, California, the REGI states are now 10 states. And this interesting little fact at the bottom is that the carbon profiles of these regions together exceeds those of most nations. Okay, and which tools are adequate or appropriate for the power sector? Cap and trade options, obviously that's what we're here to talk about. Should we put the obligation on the generators, the suppliers of electricity? Then that raises the question of allocation of the allowances. That's what we've been talking about. Or should we put them on the load-serving entities, those who purchase power on behalf of ultimate users, people who make purchase decisions? Then there's some of the non-cap options, portfolio management, which is exercised in this state quite well. I understand that your utilities are filing, in fact, Xcel has just filed a new integrated resource plan that identifies some a whole portfolio of actions it will take to reduce its carbon profile by, I think, 22% by 2015. You're already doing that. That's going to be a part of anything that you want to continue to do. And then there's the question of the carbon tax. Just want to put these all out there. Don't have to ask that question. You already know. I've already asked this question. If I'm going too quickly, let me know. It just seems to me that we've been through a lot of this. Again, what's the best point of regulation in the power system? You're going to, I'll tip you off. You've already heard it from me. For the power sector, I'm inclined to believe it's the load-serving entity that ought to be the point of regulation, and we'll talk about why. Okay, REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. The Regulatory Assistance Project has been a technical advisor to the state working group, in REGI, so we have more than a passing acquaintance with it. It's a regional power cap, regional cap on power sector greenhouse gas emissions. The original memorandum of understanding was signed in 2005 by 7 governors. Signed again in 2007, Massachusetts and Rhode Island had pulled out after they had originally signed on. They came back in with changes in administration. There was a model rule. Each state has to adopt the rules for REGI to work, so they're compatible amongst all the states. So it's, each state has to take the action itself. So a model rule was developed for the air regulators to adopt that would deal with all the questions that REGI raised, create all the processes, all the mechanisms. The rule, in large measure, has been adopted in its model form by, is being adopted, I should say. Vermont's rule is now under consideration. Massachusetts, Connecticut, they're all being looked at. But essentially, the model rule has formed the basis for REGI and is being proposed as the mechanism by which it will be operated. There will be a regional auction, which is now under development, for the allowances. REGI is a supply-side cap-and-trade program. The obligation is on generators geographically in the region, because, of course, it's only the generators in the states that the states have jurisdiction over. It will begin in 2009. The cap will reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the sector by 10% by 2019. 10% below an average of 3 years emissions, 2003, 2004, 2005, I believe are the years. It may be 2002, I don't recall. offhand, but it's going to reduce those emissions for the region by 10%. These are just the elements of the program. Obviously, the sources have to be, you have to identify which sources are covered, determine the total emissions. That was actually done. You will issue allowances. There is an organization called REGI Inc. that is made up of of environmental regulators in the various states, and it will manage the process. And then there will be trading and, in fact, offsets, and we'll talk about those in a minute. Offsets, in effect, are additional allowances. Another form of carbon mitigation, so it's like an allowance, or it's like taking any other carbon reduction, GHG emission reduction step. Yeah, this is the sort of page to focus on. I'm going to try to stay away from too much detail unless you want it. The REGI program elements, what does it cover? Power plants larger than 25 megawatts. Told you already, it'll stabilize emissions by 2015 and reduce them by 2019. Allocations. Each state has a budget, a carbon budget for its power sector, and each state determines how those credits or allowances will be allocated. So there is what we call apportionment amongst the states and then allocation amongst the generators. Okay. There are 3-year compliance periods. This refers to banking. In effect, you have 3 years in which to meet your carbon reduction goals. Offsets. I'll come to another page on offsets in a moment. You can earn offsets or credits from off-sector reductions. There are safety valves. Here, what we're talking about are price triggers that allow for additional actions to be taken for generators to receive credits for carbon reduction so that the price of the allowances does not get too high. This is a major concern, and it's obviously one that you rightly have as well, and that is, how much is this going to cost? Can we afford it? What will be the impact on the economy? And what can we do if the price does get too high, for whatever reason, for reasons of speculation in the auction, in the allowance market, which I'm not as concerned about, but it's certainly a more than reasonable question. But what if reductions can't be made in the sector itself? And what are you going to do? Because as the allowances become more scarce, the price goes up. So there are several safety valves, and I'll describe them in a moment. Leakage. This is a problem that still has to be addressed by REGI. It's a problem that I understand that you have acknowledged in your recent legislation and that you want to address directly, and I think that's terrific. And we'll talk about some ways to do so. And then, of course, the overall program will be reviewed in a few years to make sure it's working the way folks thought. And just as a legal note here, this gets to the question of multi-state compacts and federalism and so on. And I'm not a lawyer. I played one for 11 years, but I'm not one. There is no REGI government. It's a set of reciprocity agreements. Okay, the cap structure. We've already sort of gone over this. It's a generator-side cap. It applies to units that are greater than 25 megawatts in size, and the cap is set according to a baseline, which is just average emissions for 3 years in the early 2000s that I mentioned earlier. We asked the question, is this a particularly stringent goal of reducing this 10% goal by 2019? Given what other states are trying to do, I don't think this goal is as stringent as it could be. It's a start. And that's, in my Promethean sense, where the hope lies at the start. So I referred to this earlier. This is the overall emissions cap for the 10 states. It was allocated, it was apportioned amongst the states through political means. There is some logic to the apportionment. related to total production of generation in the various states. But as you can imagine, it was a roll-up-your-sleeves, you know, duke-it-out political agreement. The states then determine themselves how those allowances get allocated. And it's important to understand that as a regional agreement that depends upon states taking individual action, each state can allocate those allowances however it wants. In the original MOU, the original agreement amongst the governors, they agreed to a minimum of 25% of the allowances to be allocated on behalf of consumers. You call that the consumer allocation, and what that meant is on behalf of consumers could mean any one of a number of things, but the money that would be raised from selling those allowances would be used to serve consumers in some means or another. The object was to have those monies used to take carbon-reducing and cost-reducing steps, actions, in the power sector on behalf of consumers. So first and foremost was the idea of investing those dollars in additional energy efficiency, end-use energy efficiency measures, as well as other clean energy actions, you know, renewable, some R&D, that sort of thing. But the idea here was, here were dollars, the asset that Professor Polanski referred to earlier, that's going back to the consumer. We're not going to spend any time on this. This is the apportionment. So they're the percentages. We want to see that. We can talk about it. But again, it was sort of hard-nosed political wrangling. Okay. Flexibility. Carbon cap and trade mechanism. If the overall goal is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions at the lowest possible cost, how do you design the program? What do you want it to do? One of the things you want it to be able to do is be flexible, to allow flexibility and innovation in response to the mandate. So, in order to minimize volatility in allowance prices and hardship on particular generators or generating companies, a three-year compliance period. That means that we're not looking at how much I'm generating in the way of, or producing in the way of carbon emissions on a yearly basis, but on a three-yearly basis. Okay, I'm allowed to, I've got 3 years that I have to comply with my needs, with my requirements, and I'm also allowed to bank. That is, if I have extra allowances, I'm allowed to carry them forward. Now, I'm not allowed to borrow. This is a subtle difference. I'm not allowed to borrow allowances from the future to meet today's needs, okay? But I am allowed to bank excess allowances today to meet tomorrow's needs, or sell them, or retire them. Offsets are permitted. We'll come to that. I talked about the safety valve provisions. We're going to come to that. And leakage. This is, again, a very important problem. If you don't solve the leakage problem, it is an effect, a safety valve. And I have to tell you that some folks in the Reggie region understood this from the get-go and were happy to see that. Now, I think that and it's not to criticize. People understood what the problems were and were concerned about some of the economic implications, or what they thought might be the economic problems, and realized that leakage is going to be this means by which price mitigating a downward pressure on allowance prices might be maintained. And by leakage, if it's not clear, we're talking about imports from out of region, which are not regulated under the proposal. Okay, offsets. What are you allowed to do? Natural gas, propane, heating oil efficiency. You can invest in reductions of energy use in that sector, and obviously the home and commercial business, the heating sector, and by doing so, reduce the carbon output of heating and cooling buildings. Land to forest, putting land aside to create forest, and the question came up earlier and the issue came up earlier, this is very difficult. Just how much you're actually sequestering in the way of carbon is a major question there. Landfill gas capture and combustion would qualify as an offset. Methane capture from animal operations. SF6, sulfur hexafluoride. Is that right? Sodium hexafluoride. Is that right? My chemistry is awful. A very, very powerful greenhouse gas, and it's far more, on a volume basis, far more problematic than carbon dioxide. And so, talk to me, if you can take actions to reduce the leaks of SF6, you can get credit for that. These are all, by the way, offset actions that you take within the REGI region. Leak detection and natural gas distribution, because as you know, methane is a more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide as well. You can do these anywhere in the United States, except, as you see in the next bullet, the offsets that are outside the REGI states are discounted by 50%. In other words, for every ton that you save outside of the REGI region, you only get a half a ton of credit. Okay? Inside the region, you get a one-to-one credit. And the limit on use is that each source may cover up to 3.3% of its total reported emissions through offsets. And that number relates to this graph. And I put this up here as an example of sort of the hard thinking and political deal making that went into REGI. But essentially, what you see on this graph is the red line is the cap. The difference between halfway between the cap and business as usual. The red line is roughly current emissions levels. Okay. Ignoring any increases under business as usual, which is 1.5 to 2% increases in emissions and electric usage in the REGI region over the next 15 years. The red line says this is where you are if you just stay where you are. Okay. The difference between the red line and the blue line can be achieved by doing offsets up to 3.3% of your total need. So in a sense, what has been designed is that half the requirement could be met through offsets year to year to year, as they accumulate. And it was, again, a very thoughtful design with respect to addressing the concern about the potential for the prices of the allowances to be pushed up higher than people were willing to have them go up. As you'll see, we're talking about maximum prices of $10 a ton. And most folks are thinking we're going to start off around $2. There's a safety valve at $7. And here's the first one, a $7 trigger for allowance. What happens is, what happens when you hit these triggers? New actions are allowed to be taken, and they have primarily to do with offsets. The limit on offset use is increased to 5% of a source's reported emissions. So now you can go out and get more offsets. Now you can go anywhere in North America for the offsets and get a one-to-one credit when the price hits $7. So that's a pretty powerful change in the structure of REGI. Okay. At $10, the compliance period is extended for 1 year, up to 3 years, so you have a maximum of a 6-year compliance period. That's going to change the complexion of meeting the requirements. If the $10 trigger is hit 2 years in a row, the limit on the use of offsets is increased to 20% of a source's reported emissions. And then offsets, again, can come from anywhere in North America and from recognized international trading regimes. There was a question about whether there should also be a price floor. What we're seeing in the design of the auction is a concern about having a price for allowances that is too low. And folks are talking about a reservation price, $1, $1.50, $2, that would allow states to withhold allowances from the auction in order to maintain a minimum price. And that would be because there are revenues associated with those allowances that in certain states, at least, folks are counting on to make investments in energy efficiency and clean energy resources. The reason this has come up is because what folks have discovered is that the three-year average, the period that forms the baseline, the three-year average, 2003, 4, and 5, as I say, I recall those are the years. It turns out that since then, greenhouse gas emissions have actually fallen in the region by 3 to 5%, maybe a little bit more, and consequently, the cap is in fact a license to enlarge our carbon footprint, and folks are very concerned about that. So, if you have a price floor on the allowances, and you withhold some, and states withhold allowances from the trading regime, you then have, in effect, lowered the cap. Okay. That's what folks are thinking about. These questions have not been answered. The REGI state working group and all the state policymakers are still struggling with these issues, and the auction design is still going forward. It's going to be resolved this year because the first auction is next year. Okay. You've already heard some of these points. I just want to reiterate a couple of them. The acid rain program, a terrific success story. It's smokestack-based. The allocations are free based on the historic emissions of generators. We would argue it's not the best design for a greenhouse gas cap-and-trade system, and for these reasons. The best low-cost solutions are not at the smokestack. In fact, there are no smokestack solutions, as Terry was pointing out earlier, nor in the fuel supply. There's no such thing as low-carbon coal. Moreover, in thinking about the point of regulation, thinking about how to design a carbon cap and trade program for the power sector, you need to be thinking about the power sector itself. The carbon market is big, but the electric market is much bigger. And so the design of a carbon cap and trade regime can affect market prices for electricity in ways that you may not want. And I'm going to give some examples of that. And we can talk about how this may or may not be relevant for Minnesota and for a regional program. In our view, there are really two things you need to be thinking about. It's how to allocate. Once you decide who's going to be regulated, then you have to ask the question, how are you going to allocate? Will you give them away? Will you auction them? Will there be some hybrid? And then secondly, in the power sector, I would argue that the key to the success of any of these programs is going to be energy efficiency in the short run. In this state, I believe, and you're talking about reductions of greenhouse gas emissions by 2025 of 30%. And if I understand correctly, some of the modeling that's been done shows that getting there is possible, but that you may be exhausting every trick in the book to get there. And then you ask, what do we do next? I think it's very important to think about these actions now as bridge strategies to a future that is in large measure unknown, but nevertheless one we need to confront. So, again, we need to do everything. And that will push us on this path, and let's see, what the future holds in store. I, for one, retain hope. And again, I'm optimistic certainly about the cap and trade program. I think that they're a good way to go. They support, if properly designed, they support portfolio management activities. I think they're much more effective than a carbon tax for reasons that I'm going to mention in a moment. In this case, architectural mistakes. There are three wrong assumptions that folks make. Now, in part, some of what I'm going to talk about has to do with. I need to pick up the pace. Okay. Let me. Well, give me a moment. Let's think about where we want to focus our attention then. Let me just make these three points, and we can come back to these in questions. One assumption is that generators lose money under carbon cap and trade, so designers must give them the allowances for free. Simply not true. Second one is just manage the pollution, price increases, and demand elasticity will deliver efficiency and other responses. We found that that is not true. To change the dispatch and thus the emissions profile of the power sector, at least in the RGGI region, the value of a ton of carbon would have to go to $50 in order to change the order of dispatch and the amount of carbon emissions from the sector as a whole. And this question came up earlier. Allocation is just distributional. Initial allocation won't affect program costs to consumers. We don't think that's true either. So let me speed ahead, and I can come back to all those. Let me go to what is being done in RGGI. Okay. Modeling was found that, in modeling, they found that carbon credit prices would drop 25% as a consequence of significant investment in energy efficiency, and the need for fossil fuel capacity dropped by 33%. And the best thing here is customers' bills drop from 5 to 12%. Efficiency saves money. And even greater investments would yield even greater savings. RGGI is a carbon cap and trade program that applies to the generators in a competitive wholesale market. And the concern naturally is that if the generators have the allowances, the value of the allowance shows up in the price that they bid into the market. The allowance is something they need. It's a variable cost per operation. Whether they pay for it or whether it's given to them, the value of the allowance shows up in the price that they charge for electricity, both in the short-term market and in bilateral contracts. And that creates significant windfalls because if it affects the, again, this is a wholesale market in New England and in the East, that's unlike the market that you're operating here. We can talk about that. But in any case, the point I want to make is that the value of the allowance is in the price of power. Everybody in the power market benefits from that, even those who don't need allowances, and that raises the total bill. So you want to think about that. In any case, what they did in RGGI, what the states have done in RGGI, is they took that that admonition for a 25% allocation of the allowances to the states on behalf of consumers, and every state in the RGGI region has stated or has already adopted rules or laws that it will allocate 100% or very close to 100% of the allowances on behalf of consumers for investment in clean energy resources, and in certain cases for support for certain sectors of the economy. But for the very large measure, it's going to go. The monies are going to go to investing in energy efficiency and clean energy resources. So the generators will have to purchase them. Okay, now that means that the price of the allowance is certainly going to be in the price of power, but at least the dollars have now come back to the consumers. Okay, the dollars for the allowance isn't needed. Okay, so part of that windfall is then recycled to consumers. This was a very important development when all the states recognized this. And this goes to the question that you asked about the EU. In the EU, again, a competitive power market, the allowances were given to generators for free. Because those allowances can be traded, they have value, and thus they show up in generators' bids into the market. Okay, they bid the marginal cost of generation, and they bid the value of the allowance because they want to get that money. If they need to retire the allowance in order to generate, it has as much value to them as it does if they sell it to someone else who needs it. So that's going to show up in prices. And in fact, work that was done in the EU showed that was the case, that anywhere from 60 to 100% of the value of the allowance showed up in the market price for power in every hour. The only reason it was ever below 100% was because in certain hours there was so much natural gas generation on the margin competing with each other that generators actually did discount their bids because of the free allowance. They were able to use that free allowance and discount the bids a little bit. But still, they never went for zero. And so that is, in my view, one of the concerns you want to keep in mind when you think about allocation. In a fully vertically integrated industry, you can recapture the costs of the allowances, and any sale of the allowances will be recaptured through the rate making process. Any revenues that a utility receives show up as a credit to the cost of service. In a restructured, or I'll put it in quotes, deregulated power market, that's not going to be the case. So you actually have means here to at least mitigate the cost of the allowance program on consumers and not have it affect the dispatch prices, but you still want to be thinking about what to do with the dollar. Let me pass this one by as well. It's what I've just said. Wanted to make a point about dispatch once again. We talked about whether a carbon tax would make sense, and would that just, you know, assure that people's behavior changes in response to the prices. There's been some modeling. I suspect you've already seen it, but here in the upper Midwest, a carbon charge of $25 a ton would raise wholesale power prices by $21 a megawatt hour. That's about 2 cents a kilowatt hour. But even at $50 a ton would only produce a 4% reduction in regional emissions given your current generation mix. It's not going to change dispatch in any meaningful way. It may have a long-term impact on the generation choices in the future, but the tax itself is not going to have an immediate effect. All it will do is raise prices, and you'll spend a lot of money to get a very small reduction in emissions. Whereas through a cap and trade program, with the value of the allowances allocated to clean energy policies, you can get a much bigger bang for the dollar. This is something, again, that as you design these programs, as you're thinking about these programs, you're going to want to investigate. Okay. And I put this in, it seemed apropos, certainly, of some of the questions earlier asked. Okay, I'm just going to go right to the last problem, and then we're done. And that's leakage. The problem in REGI is that the border states, in particular New Jersey, Maryland, D.C., Delaware, and that's all of them, are part of the PJM Interconnect, the PJM regional market, and have contracts for system power from producers in Pennsylvania and Virginia, West Virginia, and so on. And in fact, buy a lot of short-term power on the wholesale market. And the question is, how will REGI affect their imports? Right now in New Jersey, I'm not sure what the number is. It's 3-5% of their energy, maybe more, maybe it's 10%. I can't remember offhand. Comes in from outside of the region, in contracts that are system power or short-term trades. The question then becomes, the generators in the region now have a carbon obligation and an additional cost that shows up in the cost that they charge, in the prices that they charge. But that's not true of the generators outside the region. Will the purchases of power, the load-serving entities, is true in region generation or out-of-region generation, and will you significantly increase imports to get the lower price power and thus, in fact, avoid the cap altogether and have the effect of producing more carbon dioxide than the whole program is intended to allow? This has been a major concern in the REGI region, and the way the REGI MOU was originally written required that it be established that REGI itself, that the REGI program itself, would have this effect. This has been controversial because it's very difficult to measure that effect when imports are varying from year to year anyway. And it had been the advocacy of a lot of folks, both state policymakers and others, to address imports head on, and in fact to treat imports as if they were resources. The moment the power gets to the border, treat it as if it were a generator and assign a carbon value to the megawatt hours, and then require allowances to be in hand to account for that carbon value, and then everything's under the cap and off you go, and everything is part of the mix. There are some issues that have to do with monitoring and establishing what the carbon content of imports is. I think they're all resolvable. They are not easy, but they are able to be dealt with. The RGGI folks haven't gotten there yet, and this is something that's intended to be dealt with this year, but it can be a real problem. And I think that's about it. I would just finish up with this. California and Oregon are talking about a load-side cap and trade, as I discussed earlier, making the point of regulation the load-serving entity who has the ability through its portfolio management activities, its customer contact, and its purchase decisions to respond to its changes in a carbon budget much more easily and flexibly than a generator does. So put the obligation where there's a comparative advantage for dealing with it. When you do that, then the question of auction takes on a whole different quality, and I think we're probably running out of time, and I would save that for questions and answers or for coming back and chatting with whomever. But it's an alternative approach, and we think it solves the auction problem, it solves the allocation problem, it solves the import problem, and it gets you where you want to be, and that is with entities who have an obligation that they have the ability to meet, and they'll meet it in the lowest cost way, and that would be through energy efficiency and other clean energy resources. I've really flipped it over very quickly, but I'm taking too much time.
Well, we thank you too, Mr. Weston. That was a lot of information. I do have a question about when the legislation was passed for the development of RGGI. And how long where I'm getting to is, how long did it take you to get it up and running? And it obviously isn't up running yet. And do you think you'll meet your 2009 deadline?
The answer to the last question is yes. RGGI began in 2002. The whole process began. Governor Pataki of New York, it was his initiative. He brought in the six governors of the surrounding states, all of New England, seven governors, I guess. New Jersey was what came in afterwards. So New England, New York began with it, and it didn't happen through legislation. It was a directive to the environmental regulatory bodies in each of the states to work together to develop such a program. That was its virtue, but also one of its problems. They brought there was a two-year working group, as I referred to, the state working group, that developed the whole RGGI program and the model rule. And it was at that point that legislation in the various states was put into effect, and not all states did it at the same time. Vermont was the first to adopt legislation requiring that RGGI be adhered to, and that there would be a consumer allocation, and that only took 1 year. But it was a two and a half year process of a state working group, a collaborative activity of the seven or eight states.
Okay. Are you likely to open the system to others to purchase also? And then my question is, I don't know what's happened in the European market either. But what happens if a country, let's say China, enters and they have a ton of money and they come in and purchase all your allocations or purchase, you know, all whatever they're called?
All the carbon credits?
All the carbon credits. What happens?
Well, there would not be enough credits for, presumably, for the in-region generators. But let's see, why would China do that? Would China be able to purchase those allowances for credit in some other program that China is a part of? Would those credits have that currency? Off the top of my head, and maybe Terry has some thoughts on this, I don't see that happening. The concern that folks raised was about speculation and hoarding for the purposes of jacking up the price and selling them later. But with the price triggers that we have and the flexibility provisions, I think that's a fairly small concern. It's not occurring to me offhand why China or any major purchaser would do that unless these credits are recognized as currency in other trading regimes.
Okay. And then
But let me ask you first, answer your first question, which was, is Reggie interested in opening up to other purchases, other participants? I think the answer would be yes. Of course, the nature of that participation would have to be understood and appropriate. But when Reggie started out, it was only 8 states, and now it's 10. And it would be great to get Pennsylvania into it. That's the real hope, getting Pennsylvania into it. And then you might deal with the leakage problem much better.
Okay. Representative Selke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Weston, first of all, just to clarify, the reduction goal of Reggie was 10%. That's just of the electricity sector. Right? So that would amount to approximately 4% of the total regional emission. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And I'm sure that the inclusion of the industrial sector as well as the electric generation sector was considered. Can you tell me why that was not included?
For the reasons that Terry referred to earlier, it was such a big challenge to design a cap and trade program that the regulators looked to those sources that they had continuous emissions monitoring on that are already regulated, that they had really immediate control over and could get a handle on. The object is to expand the program. Well, certainly that's the hope, but just designing the program itself for the electric sector has been so much of a challenge, they didn't want to bite off more than they could chew. And then, of course, it raises all kinds of allocation issues and what should the caps be and so on. But that's where they started.
Well, Madam Chair,
Mr.
Weston, in that regard, there must be some number of industrial generators of electricity for their own use. Why would it be any more difficult to measure and cap that generation than...
Oh, I misunderstood.
Regulated.
Oh, forgive me.
I
may have misunderstood. I thought you were talking about other industrial processes as well.
Well, I was.
Okay. It wouldn't be, but the decision was made to set a floor at 25 megawatts just for, I believe, and I was not a part of this at the time, but I believe because we didn't feel that the states did not feel that there were so many of them that they made a difference. In fact, their impacts were de minimis in the region.
Yeah. Representative Bruce.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about the offsets, and I'm wondering, the offsets that you identified, do they rise to the standard of being quantifiable and verifiable and would not have otherwise occurred?
Great question. I'd like to point that out. There are, in the REGI rule, that the model rule, and as I say, states are adopting it, it requires that the offsets be real, surplus, verifiable, permanent, and enforceable. We refer to that as RSVPE. This hasn't been tested yet. We'll see what happens when people start delivering offsets as credits. I believe that's an extremely high standard to meet. I think it's an important standard. that they be real, that something is actually happening. Surplus is the word, is a synonym for the word you heard earlier, additionality. So that they are, the action taken would not have been taken but for the REGI program and the desire to purchase an offset. It's got to be verifiable, which goes to the enforceable as well, and they have to be permanent. That's a very high standard to meet. We'll see. We'll see what happens.
Representative Knuth?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a few questions, if I can ask. Sure. So the first one is for the EU emissions trading scheme. Is that just the power sector, or what sectors does that cover?
That's multi-sector, I believe, but I'm not sure all of who's involved. I've just concentrated on the power sector part of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, in the EU system,
Dr. Pulaski, why don't you come to the third chair up here?
The EU countries are under the Kyoto Protocol, so the country itself has to meet an emissions target. So, you know, it's in their interest to basically have as much coverage as they can. I don't know the details on which, you know, sort of how far they go, but basically, you know, the country has to meet, you know, the country is capped, and then so the sectors within that, you know, they have to make sure that those sectors meet it. And there's been interest in the EU of having the flexibility to have multiple sectors and to expand the trading network as widely as they could.
Representative,
thank you, Madam Chair. The other question, I think you alluded to it, but the model rule for the REGI initiative was written by a stakeholder group over a two-year process, so there was not really input by the legislature before that model rule was.
That's correct. It was written by the state working group, which was made up of primarily state environmental regulators from the REGI states, but also, and this is very important, I want to emphasize this, but also state utility regulators. I just want to go back and say that the carbon market's big, the power market's even bigger, and you want to make sure that you've got your key policymakers involved in the design of these programs, because there can be really unintended impacts associated with the design of a program on the other market, the underlying market. So there were utility regulators involved, but not to the degree that I think should have been. They really need to be thinking at first farther ahead on this issue. And I think the REGI design is, because it's a supply side design, comes from the fact that it was air regulators who were designing it, who had the primary role for charge for designing it, and they were thinking about their tools. How do we regulate as air regulators? And that's why it's a supply side cap. Whereas, think a little more broadly, and certainly with a multi-sectoral approach, you'll be thinking about different points of regulation and compatibility with the underlying market.
Representative, one more, Madam Chair. Thank you. So, when the rules were adopted, the legislature had to adopt the rules in these various. I'm looking for where the legislature was involved in REGI and how they, you know, as elected officials in those states, were part of the process. And as well, just in addition to that, if you could talk a little bit about the difference between the rules being adopted in different states and how the rules tweak them or change them to work for their state.
Okay.
Mr. Weston.
Thank you. The legislatures have been primarily involved in, well, two ways. In Vermont, for example, the legislature passed a statute that said, REGI, it's a good thing. We want to be a part of it. And we want all of our allowances to be auctioned off on behalf of customers. So it was, you know, a flag in the ground or whatever the expression would be. This is what we're going to do. We are making a decision this is how we're going to allocate them. We're going to auction them and allocate and take the monies and use them for energy efficiency and renewables and a couple other things. Clean energy fund that we have in the state. So that was a directive to the air regulators who, in adopting, in drafting a rule that would determine how the program operates, again, the model rule, almost word for word, the model rule, it says in it, 100% consumer allocation through an auction process, the dollars to be used for such and such, and will go and will be managed in this way, and will not be part of the general fund. The dollars are, nothing's ever bulletproof, but they're darn close to being bulletproof. Obviously the legislature can go back and get that money if it wants. But the idea was to segregate the money and have it stay in the, dedicated for these purposes. So that's what the statute did. The legislature then comes back after the rulemaking process. We go through our agency rulemaking processes, and this is true of the other states as well. There has to be, and I presume it's the case here, a legislative rules committee or some action by the legislature that ultimately approves the rule that the agency has proposed. So you get a second bite at the apple in that sense. Now, how does the rule differ in various states? What we've seen so far, the proposed rules have differed mostly in this allocation issue. The mechanics of being a part of REGI, they're pretty straightforward. The safety valves, the offsets. I think in a couple cases, some states, and I have to check on this for you, I think there are a few more offsets that I think Maine has allowed, and this has to do with forestry and so on, things I just am not that familiar with, but I can get answers for you. But primarily, it has to do with how the allocation is going to work and who's going to get the money. And in the case of the state of Maine, again, a 100% consumer allocation, except, so it's not really 100%, except for allowances associated with two combined heat and power systems that are favored for some particular reason. I don't know.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, I had a few questions, too, and I'll start with just following up on Representative Knuth. So you're saying that each state in REGI will collect the auction dollars state by state and then set the policy for how they're allocated? That is not agreed to among all the states.
Mr. Webster.
Each state gets to do with the dollars as it wishes. It can decide how to allocate its allowances. It could give them all to generators to do whatever it wants, except for this 25% minimum. All the states did agree originally to a 25% minimum consumer allocation, but they don't really have to do it. If you think about it, there's no enforcement. New Jersey can't make Vermont do something it doesn't want to do. But if REGI's going to work, the rules have to be awfully similar, so that there's some compatibility. But as far as the allocations are concerned, the states are entirely free to do what they want. Again, this is not a, again, I don't, I'm not a lawyer, so I can't speak about these issues with any knowledge, but I know it's not a compact, and thus doesn't require federal approval. They were very careful to design it in a way that depends upon states deciding whether they're going to be in REGI or not be in REGI, and then agreeing to do these things. So you can do whatever you want with the dollar.
Okay.
So you can do whatever you want with the dollar.
Okay, and then
Senator Anderson?
So you said the states as a whole agreed to this minimum 25%, but did you also say that every state has ultimately agreed to 100% within their own state?
We're very close to it.
Okay.
We're very close to it, yes.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Anderson.
I wanted to follow up on the discussion you had about the European Union and their experience. I think what I heard you say is that the problem is that they gave the allowances away, prices went up, but there was no way to protect consumers from the impact of those prices because they didn't bring in any revenue.
That's correct.
More or less what you said. And then you also went on to talk about regulated states versus non-regulated states on the electricity side, at least. And I think what I heard you say was, in our state, because we're regulated, we could cushion that blow to consumers by, you know, by determining the rate of return, for example, we could say that those costs were not recoverable by utilities if they're charged, for example. As an option, that might be an extremely difficult thing to do. But the alternative, I think the overall message you're giving us is that the allowance, the point of selling the allowances is to provide a fund to help cushion the cost to consumers of the increased price.
That was certainly the intent in Reggie.
Okay.
To use those dollars for good things. If I may take 30 seconds to use the slide that I would give to explain this problem just a little bit, if I may, Madam Chairman. Otherwise,
you certainly may.
This is the economists here will appreciate the supply curve. And what you see is price on one side and megawatt hours on the other. And as megawatt hours increase, the price goes up. You know, and this is, think about this as on an hourly basis. This is 1 hour. Here's the problem. We're talking about a competitive market for generation, which is not what we're talking about in Minnesota, but I want to start there because this is what happened in the EU. You see the old market clearing price. It's that intersection of the lower dotted line with the curved line going up, and that's what the price would be somewhere, you know, whatever that is. And the area under the curve is how much money people spend in total to buy power at that price, whatever that price is. So if that lower price is, you know, 5 cents a kilowatt hour times all the megawatt hours, that's what you pay. That's the total bill to society. But here's what happens. When a generator has a carbon obligation, it has a cost associated with that, and the cost is the allowance. And the point I was trying to make before is whether you give the allowance to the generator for free or whether you make the generator pay for the allowance, either way, the value of the allowance is going to show up in the price of electricity. And a lot of work's been done to establish this, and economists appreciate it. It's called the opportunity cost. But that beige area, that next line up, that's what happens. And the thing is, you're paying for that additional value across all the kilowatt hours, not just the one at the margin, but for all the ones to the left. And so if there's a generator somewhere to the left who never needed an allowance, it's making that much more money on its sales, the value of the allowance. Now, as markets go, economists will tell you that's okay. And in fact, that's how our commodities markets work. What I'm telling you is that's an awfully expensive way to get to the result that you want, which is lowering carbon and lowering and minimizing the cost to consumers. And I think you can do it in a different way entirely, and that goes to the load side allocation. And I think this is, you know, subject matter for a longer discussion. But at the very least, what you can do is sell the allowances and give the money back to consumers in some way that benefits them. So at least you get part of the money back.
Can I follow up, Madam Chair?
Senator Ed.
I guess the one thing I would add is that, you know, even if we have a regulated electricity system, I think our law says the MTAG is going to come back with an offset, with a broader multi-sector recommendation, so, you know, that regulation won't apply in the other sectors. So that's only in the electricity sector. But I just have two more questions, if I can. I'll just throw them out, maybe both out there. Totally unrelated. One is about the load serving, about the leakage issue. And it sounded to me like what you were saying is that because your regulation is on generators, that if you, you know, that gives you an incentive to buy your power from another state. But if you put the regulation on the distribution utilities, then that won't happen, and that would help to minimize leakage.
That's my argument,
Mr. Weston.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I keep interrupting. Forgive me.
I just need to identify you for the tape.
That's what I thought. Yeah, that's the argument we're making.
Okay. And then last question,
Senator Anderson.
And this only occurred to me. I wish I'd asked Mr. Tamminen this because I think he's maybe left. I saw him go out the door. Because it just sort of sunk in. He made the comment about how their models show in California, and either one of you can answer this, I guess, whoever wants to, but in California that their overall plan will save all these billions of dollars. And when I was at the Climate Change Advisory Group this past week, listening to them, when they came and testified to our committee this week, they talked about the dollars. And it was, what I hadn't heard before is that they said the Center for Climate Strategy said that if we adopted every one of those recommendations on their list of, you know, 50 possible ones, it would save the state of Minnesota $9 billion. And I was really surprised to hear that. And I think there's sort of a pattern here that overall the plans that we're talking about to meet these emissions reductions goals maybe save the state money, but all we're hearing about is how costly it's going to be on an, you know, in terms of those who buy this regulated, this power that now has the price of carbon in it. So how do we reconcile those big cost savings on the macro scale with the cost to consumers or to generators of power that we're talking about in this system? How do you reconcile those? Is it really going to save us money in the big picture, but...
It depends on how you meet your carbon obligation. Again, what you're hearing from me is that the cheapest, most abundant, most cost-effective, I guess I'm repeating myself, response to this problem is end-use energy efficiency. And on a carbon basis, on a dollars per ton basis, it's a negative cost to you because energy efficiency is cost-effective without even thinking about the carbon. So it's free carbon reduction. So any action you can take to depress demand puts money back in the pockets of your homes and businesses. It also reduces the pressure on the price for the allowances themselves, and it changes the overall supply mix that you're faced with. In the long run, saves you money. And that's where I'm coming from on that.
Well, actually, you had a nice, you know, your slide, the one says the Vatten cell, the one, you know, you're talking about, I think.
Yep.
Back to plastic. So one answer here is, just as Rick said, the slide here, there are a number of options that you can take that, even ignoring the environmental benefits, save you money. Okay, well, you know, then if you're doing that, I mean, you should do that, plus you're getting environmental benefits, so... So clearly, there can be some savings there. In most of the cases, though, that I've seen where we're talking about trying to reduce to, you know, let's say 20% below 2005 levels or 30% below, people are usually talking, you know, we're getting into the right-hand side of the curve where it's above. So the marginal cost of taking further emissions, it is costly. I mean, it does require some expenditure, you know, either by the company or somebody to accomplish the objective. So I don't know the specifics of this. I'd be actually very interested in this. The only other reconciliation I can think about would be that, the reason why we're doing this is because there are benefits to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So if we looked at trying to quantify in dollar terms what the benefits of those emissions are, maybe that's what people are saying, that, you know, we save money. But otherwise, I don't really know, other than if it's on the left-hand side of the curve where, you know, it's a positive return to take the action on both the economy and the environment. But once you get... You know, once you get into the areas of having electric utilities, for example, reduce the amount of emissions by switching loads or doing other things, you're into positive cost. So I'm not sure I can.
Well, all I can say, Madam Chair, is I know in the Minnesota Climate Change Group, I know they're not trying to quantify environmental benefit in those numbers. They may have some health impact quantified in there, but okay, someone's shaking his head. I think it's a straight cost to consumers, you know, not without externalities included. I see Bill is nodding his head. So, Grant, anyway. But anyway, maybe we could get some more work from you on that. That would be really helpful.
If I just may add, some of these other areas for efficiency savings are not in the sector itself. For example, in non-regulated fuels, so building envelope efficiency, heating and ventilation, air conditioning systems, again, all have the effect of improving amenity value and reducing costs when you make those investments, and that's another area of savings that ultimately would be a negative cost to reducing carbon. So in a multi-sectoral approach, I'm sure, I would imagine all those kinds of things, I'm only thinking of a couple here, would be included.
Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. It sounds like the Red V train is pretty far down the track, but if you had to do it over again, you wouldn't be at the generator side. You'd be at the load side.
I would
be. Western.
I would be. The load side cap idea was my partner's idea, a gentleman named Richard Cowart, whom I'm sitting in for, and I certainly encourage you to invite him. He'll tell you more and much more eloquently than I. But we worked on this a lot at RAP and through the Red Heat work, and we tossed this idea around, and we really think that it solves so many, addresses so many problems. It's not perfect. By no means perfect, but I think it addresses, as I said, the leakage problem, the allocation and auction problem, and the market price of power problem.
Just a quick follow-up.
Representative Hartman.
Mr. Weston, do you agree with the other two speakers that a state cap trade and auction couldn't be effective on its own? I mean, it sounds like whether it's a regional entity or a state by itself, you have the leakage issue, you have the offsets issues. To me, the advantage of one state taking action, especially if you take the lessons learned from the EU and from Reggie, and we can not make those mistakes again, is that we can act much more quickly than waiting for a regional agreement where you're trying to coordinate with 10 different governors.
Mr. Weston.
I'm not sure I heard the other two speakers say that a one-state program wouldn't work. But I do agree with their general conclusion that the bigger the market, the better it is. But I'm not sure that one wouldn't work. What would matter is how the cap is set, who gets the allowances. Now you have fewer numbers of traders, and you do have a problem of monopoly or monopsony power in the market for allowances. So you'd want to be thinking about that. And you certainly want to design it in a way that would allow for expansion to other states. But I'm not sure that it wouldn't work. I just don't think it would work as well.
I think Mr. Tamminen, paraphrasing, but I believe Mr. Tamminen said that California, being as big as it is, could not operate a cap and trade on its own.
I wasn't listening. Forgive me.
Madam Chair, just exploring the extent to which Mr. Tamminen was reflecting the view of the majority of people looking at this problem, or just, you know, a minority view. Because we have to learn to walk before we run, so I think it's something we should continue to explore as legislators, whether there's a possibility that a one-state step forward is better than waiting for a 10-state step forward, possibly many years down the road.
I'm paraphrasing again, but I believe he said that the cost would be prohibitive, that in a small market.
Maybe he's right, maybe he's wrong.
Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a follow-up to Representative Hartman's question. I mean, it seems from what you've been talking about, there's two ways to make a market bigger. If you're doing just the power sector, you go to more states, but you can also bring more sectors into the actual cap. So you could perceive that am I right in saying there's two ways to make a cap and trade market bigger?
Sure.
At least, I mean, in theory.
Yeah, sure. And I think ultimately you want a multi-sector program. That solves the offsets problem for you. In fact, that's one of the concerns in Reggie, is you've got all these offsets. Where do you go? You go to other sectors. And at some point or another, I think reasonable people agree that we're going to have some kind of multi-sectoral program, either on a regional basis or a national basis. And there won't be any offsets because everybody's going to be a part of it in some way or another. Another reason why that RSVPE standard, being as tough as it is a good thing.
Okay. Doctor?
What? I'll just make a very quick comment and kind of in response here. I mean, I think that it's not, I wouldn't agree that it's necessarily prohibitively expensive to do this on a state level. I mean, this is a question of degrees. I mean, California is a huge economy. If it were just a New England state, California is probably still bigger than that, you know, but they were still thinking about doing this. So I agree with the broader, I mean, this is a global problem, so the broader the scope, the better. If it's a question, as you posed it, one state taking action versus waiting a long time, I would look very carefully at going at with the one state. In doing that, I'd make sure that I design my rules such that it could fit with later regional or national programs. But.
Okay. Well, I thank both of you gentlemen. I see that Mr. Kamenin has left, but I thank both of you gentlemen for your time. This certainly has been informative, and it will be helpful for us as we go forward. At this time, we'll adjourn the meeting. Thank you.